Welcome to this episode of The Wolf and the Shepherd. Today, we're going to talk about the iPhone. And before you say, oh, I've read enough articles about the iPhone. No, we're not going to talk about the iPhone as far as what you can do with it and blah, blah, blah. We're going to talk about the iPhone as far as it being a serial killer. This device truly has went through and just slaughtered so many other industries. And even though myself and my co-host, we both have iPhones, we swear by them, we tell people constantly, oh, you don't have an iPhone, I'm sorry, you must have wronged somebody in a prior life, and that's why you're not carrying an iPhone, things like that. I mean, we swear by iPhones, we love iPhones, but the kind of saga behind the iPhone and what it has done is actually interesting when you kind of delve deep into it. So where exactly did that iPhone, where did the iPhone start out?
Well, the first iPhone was actually released back in 2007 on June 29th. I remember at the time I watched a clip of the launch and...
And of course, by the way, we're talking in the Steve Jobs days.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. I mean, he's still alive. He's wearing his black turtleneck and not taking a shower and all that good stuff and introducing this phone.
Can you hear those police sirens outside?
Yeah. I think they are sending people on there because they think maybe we're talking bad about the iPhone.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
And we're not talking bad about the iPhone.
No.
So please, Apple, stop. Stop sending the police to try to get us. We're not talking bad about it. We just said we both have iPhones. So this is not disparaging at all.
Yeah. Now, I remember back when it came out and I watched the clip. And I can't remember if it was on YouTube or whether I watched it on a blog. But I watched it and to be honest, I wasn't that impressed.
Really?
And I think the reason I wasn't impressed was because I just couldn't see that I would use the functionality it had when, you know, I could, if I really had to do something that urgent, I could, you know, take my laptop with me.
Oh, you know, see, look what happened. You just started to say my iPad and do that. That's what they've done to us, right? That's what they've done. But I see where you were getting at.
Yeah.
You said, well, I can use my computer for this.
Yeah.
But that's what they did. We just didn't know they were doing that to us so long ago of saying you can do all this stuff with a phone.
Mm-hmm.
With a phone.
Yeah.
I mean, I can honestly say I remember when I was trying to explain when I got my first iPhone that it's not a phone. It's not really a phone. It's a computer that has an application that will make phone calls.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That's honestly what it is.
Yeah.
And it was easier for them to market it as a phone.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's be honest.
Exactly. And so anyway, I didn't seem too impressed with it when it was first announced. But the day of epiphany came actually when I was at a soccer game, and remember, I used to coach soccer in North Texas for almost 20 years, and my manager on my 1997 girls team pulled out an iPhone, and I was kind of looking at her using it. And at the time, I remember I had a BlackBerry Pearl, one of those little trackables.
Oh, yeah.
And the only game you could play on it was... like I think Snake and Brick Breaker, those were the only two games.
Right.
And that, you know, central ball after about 2 months would wear out.
Yeah, you had to pop the ball out, clean the ball, or actually go buy a new one because it would wear out. And it was terrible.
Yeah. And it was, I think, because it was quite a small phone, I think it still had where you had to hit the button like four times to get to a certain letter. So it really used to make you work for sending a text.
Sure.
You know.
But you're also talking about back in the day when texting was kind of in its infancy. I mean, you could send a text message even from a flip phone, but you were sending very short text messages. I mean, you were still picking up the phone and calling somebody. You were not texting like we do nowadays where most people don't even talk on the phone. It's just text messaging back and forth.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, so after I first saw her, my manager use this iPhone, I was watching her and I was looking at my phone, and I went through a brief period of self-hatred. And then I think within about 3 months, I bought myself an iPhone, and then I, you know, upgraded pretty much every year up until the iPhone 6. And I stuck with that one for about 4 or 5 years until recently. I got the iPhone 8 because I still like that physical bezel on there.
Yeah. I know. And you make fun of me because I've got the one without the bezel and all that, but you know, I trust it. It's been a good phone.
Yeah.
So I'm still good without that physical button on there.
Now the iPhone 12, is actually going to be released October 23rd, this month, 2020. Now, you know, the first iPhone for the basic 4 gig model was $499, which even at that time, I mean, it was a lot of money.
That was 13 years ago, a lot of money to splash on a phone. That was big money for a phone.
Yeah.
Big money for a phone.
Yeah. But, you know, the new iPhone 12, the basic model is going to be $799, and the top model is going to be $1,099.
Wow.
Could you ever imagine? I mean, even as iPhone prices went up, that there'd be a phone pretty much $1,100.
I would like to say that's a used car, right? It's a terrible used car, but it's still a used car. So you can either have a brand new phone or a terrible used car. And until Apple figures out a way to turn their phone into a car to take you from point A to point B, they haven't figured that out yet. But let's not hold our breath too long, because Apple might be able to figure out a way to do that, right?
Right, yeah.
You look at spending that kind of money and you say, well, I could buy a motorcycle, or I could buy a crappy used car or something for $1,000 versus having a phone in my pocket.
Yeah. Yeah, and the prices of iPhones explain, you know, this next point about the, although the iPhone only has about 39% share of the smartphone ownership market in the United States, it actually has over 90% of profit in the market, because, you know, they make a lot more money per model than, you know,
its competitors. That makes sense. I mean, you got a lot of smartphones out there right now, and it's pretty much, do you have an iPhone or do you have something other than an iPhone? Nobody says, do you have a blah, blah, blah phone? They either say, do you have an iPhone, or, oh, you don't? Well, what kind of phone do you have? That's what people look at. And that's what's crazy, is what Apple was able to do with this smartphone market and say, you know, here is, no matter, you know, if you're an Android fan and you say, oh, we've had this forever and blah, 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 and we're not going to get into the security and all that junk because we're not that kind of podcast, right?
Yeah.
But there is that thought behind, you either have an iPhone or you don't have an iPhone.
Right.
There's no either or. It's iPhone or not an iPhone.
Right.
And that's what's crazy about this.
And there's an amazing amount of snobbery still. There didn't used to be quite so much snobbery kind of after the iPhone craze kind of settled down, but now it's kind of made a resurgence with these higher-end models where people, you know, can now boast, hey, I'm spending $1,100 on a phone. You know, it's like the Instagram billionaires and millionaires and stuff. But when the first iPhone came out, you know, the profitability, I think, was pretty good, and this was before the App Store was developed. Now, the App Store, when the introduction of that came in, is what changed the phone, not necessarily the hardware, but the utilization of that hardware through the software and the new APIs and the operating system
makes
and stuff
sense.
And made the phone do a lot more stuff than it could before using the hardware that it had on it.
Right. Yeah, because there were always things that were out there that had basically what you would call pre-installed applications, and then you couldn't expand it at all. You know, here's what this will do, and beyond that, you know, that's it. If you're going to do something else, well, you're going to have to figure out a way around it, but this is what this device will do. You had the Palm Pilots that were out. You had Sony Clié. I had one of those. You had all these other devices, but everything was pre-installed. It was proprietary. You couldn't expand it. You couldn't change it. This is what this device will do. And like you said, then the iPhone came out, and they didn't immediately have the App Store, but they knew that they had everything built as a solid foundation right. to let people go in there and customize this thing.
Yeah. Yeah, now, okay, let's play guessing game.
Oh, I love playing the guessing game yeah. because I always guess wrong. So,
it's mainly because we've stuck so far during our podcasts of asking questions which absolutely nobody but an expert in the field would actually have any idea
right.
what the answer might be even close to. So I like the way that we always set it up fair and balanced yeah. like that. Anyway, so how many iPhones do you think have been sold worldwide since the initial launch?
Wow.
So okay, maybe that's 13 years ago, just over 13 years ago.
Right, and of course, we're in 2020 right now.
Yeah.
And you said, 2007 was mm-hmm. the first launch of the yeah. iPhone. So how many iPhones have been sold in the last 13 years? And we're talking about worldwide. I'm going to yep. go with 300 million.
Really?
So I know that was a terrible guess.
Right. Take back that application your wife put in for the prices, right? Because you're wasting your time.
Yeah, I would never make that. Yeah. I mean, milk should still cost like 70 cents a gallon. Right. I don't know what anything yeah. costs.
Yeah, so. Well, it's when you guess $8 for the washing machine and dryer yeah. combo that gets you there.
Hey, I'm an old soul, right? Things should still be yeah. cheap. So obviously I'm way off.
Right. So anyway, there's actually been over 2.2 billion iPhone sold.
Wow. 2.2 billion yeah. iPhones yeah. have been sold. That's yeah. crazy. I mean, can you imagine if you owned iPhone and yeah. you just said, for every one of these sold, I make a dollar.
Yeah.
You'd have $2.2 billion. Yeah. That's ridiculous. That is crazy yeah. to think about it that way.
Yeah. To put it in a very poor example, if you travel to China and gave everybody an iPhone, that's how many iPhones there'd be.
Well, that's actually...
As in meaning there's a lot of... Yeah. There's billions of Chinese people.
Well, and so, of course, you're saying there's been 2.2 billion yeah. iPhones yeah. out there. And, of course, we know that of those 2.2 billion iPhones out there, they're not all active right now.
Yeah.
So... I'm going to guess maybe 1.2 billion of those iPhones are probably sitting in people's drawers
right.
or their 5, 6, 7-year-old kid are using it as some kind of gaming device. And I can imagine them taking those 1.2 billion iPhones to GameStop and saying, what will you give me for this? And yeah. they'd be like $26.
Yeah.
You know, something like that.
Yeah. Well, here's your second question.
Mm.
In 2017, it was estimated that what percentage of U.S. teens had an iPhone?
What percentage of U.S.
teens? In 2017. So remember, this is 3 years ago.
Wow.
So it's obviously going to be higher now.
I'm going to guess 40%.
No. 78%.
Do 78% of adults have iPhones?
Well, actually, by the end of 2019, they published some pretty up-to-date stats, and 96% of 18 through 29-year-olds had a smartphone of some description.
Sure, a smartphone, I get yeah. that. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
92% of 30 through 49-year-olds had a smartphone.
Wow.
79% of 50 through 64-year-olds had a smartphone.
Okay.
And lastly, 53% of 65-plus had a smartphone. So that's a pretty substantial chunk of the population is. Who yeah. own smartphones.
But that smartphone, not iPhone, but smartphone. you know, just like my father and my mother, and we've talked about them on the podcast before. My father's 82, my mother's 79, and I'm sorry, my father's 84 and my mother's 79. They both have iPhones, and they didn't want iPhones until I showed them what an iPhone can do, and now they have iPhones, and I think they're on their third iPhone. They have the Generation 10 iPhone. One of my favorite things about my father with his iPhone is even though he has access to the internet, he still goes old school with trying to figure stuff out.
Right.
So he's on my cell phone plan. He's on my cell phone bill. And all of a sudden I saw my cell phone bill jump up by $5. I'm like, $5, you know, why is this up $5? So I start digging into my bill, trying to figure out what happened. Well, my father had made two calls to directory assistance, the old school 411.
Oh, wow.
And they charged $2.50 for that. So I had to sit my dad down. I said, you called directory assistance to look up a phone number.
Right.
And he said, well, yeah, I was trying to figure out how to find the phone number. So I just picked up the phone and called directory assistance because it talks to the internet and tells me what the phone number is. I said, Dad, you realize you can literally just ask the phone, hey, Siri, what's the phone number for this? And it will tell you for free. I said, well, I didn't know that. How does it know what everybody's phone number is? And I said, well, that's the internet, Dad. So please stop calling directory assistance.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Now, as you mentioned right at the beginning of the episode, we entitled this iPhone
Serial Killer.
And this is basically because not the iPhone just by itself, but, you know, including the Samsung models and other smartphones in the market there.
Smartphones.
That, you know, they have largely disrupted or helped destroy some of the most traditional markets we had for decades in terms of technology, but also, you know, analog activities, which, you know, have been practiced for hundreds of years.
Oh, sure.
And the smartphones, and obviously with the high number of, you know, iPhone ownership, especially among generations of teens as they've come through, you know, the iPhone has probably done more than anybody, you know, to help kind of crush or change or remodel these industries. And so today I just wanted to go through a few of these things which the iPhone, with the help of its, you know, competitors, has actually helped change the industry or destroy the industry. Okay. And I just want you to kind of, you know, input along with my input about whether you prefer the new method of doing it on your phone or do you prefer the traditional method? Or...
Yeah, no, let's go down this list. Okay, this kind of sounds interesting. Now, so yeah, what has the serial killer iPhone destroyed?
Well, first and foremost, and especially now as opposed to maybe 5 or 6 years ago when the quality wasn't as good, digital cameras and video cameras, because now with, I think, the new iPhone, I'm not sure what it is. I mean, it's at a minimum of 12 megapixels because I think even the last ones, I think it's even more than that now. I didn't look up what the new one's got, but obviously, you know, with that amount of zoom and that amount of megapixels, and, you know, they've made the aperture wider, that, you know, unless you're a hardcore photographer.
Right. Yeah. Unless you're a real photographer out there. Right.
Yeah.
But I've owned really good cameras in my life. I've owned digital cameras. I've owned, you know, normal film cameras. And the true photographer, they're always going to say the film cameras are the best. It's kind of like me with music. I love listening to music on vinyl. I get that analog part, but let's leave that out, right? So I've had digital cameras. I had a Sony digital camera, one of the first ones they brought out. It was great. And walked all the way up, had a Nikon DSLR camera that took great pictures. But once I got into maybe my third or fourth iPhone, I realized that the pictures that this thing took was just as good as that camera.
Yeah.
and you had to remember to bring the camera with you. But you always have your phone with you. So it kind of killed the camera. It was like the video camera. You know, I remember when I was younger and I played soccer, my dad was standing on the sidelines with the video camera filming the soccer games and everything. Now it's easy to just pull your phone out of your pocket and, you know, my iPhone, your iPhone will film in 4K if you want it to.
Yeah.
And then you turn around and you can go home and you can cast it to your TV and watch what you just recorded in 4K. And it's all right there in your pocket. So you went from all these cameras where, you know, you had the 8mm and high 8, and then you had VHS cameras, and then you had the VHS-C. So you had the little tape, and it popped out, and you had to put it in the little adapter to put it in the VCR. And, you know, if you're above 20 years or below 20 years old, you don't even know what these things are, right?
Right.
But these are the things that we used to have to carry around, and then you had the batteries and all the other adapters. Now it's all in the phone, and it pretty much killed that just normal home industry of photography and videography, because you can do it just as good on your phone as having all these other devices. So why have those anymore? Nobody does.
Yeah.
Everybody just threw them away.
Yeah. Well, you see, I never had a great digital camera or I never actually had a digital video camera. I actually had an analog, a VHS one, and not the C, not the compact tapes, the ones with the full-size ones. And this thing was so heavy, you needed like a gurney to kind of move it around. But I think I was actually given it, and I had to do a little bit of fixing with some stuff on it. And I mean, it worked pretty well, but I didn't really have a use for it, because anything which I wanted to film, I wasn't carrying that thing, you know, more than about 20 yards, you know, to do anything with it. And with the camera, I think the best resolution I had on a digital camera, because I wasn't really into photography much anyway. I mean, boys, when you have to carry around a camera, you're not really kind of
right
into much. I mean, girls,
unless
have
you're
always
trying
been
to capture
it.
A
yeah.
picture of Spider-Man,
yeah,
something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah,
what are the chances of that happening?
Yeah,
repeatedly,
unless you are Spider-Man.
Right. Yeah, that's preposterous. But anyway, yeah, the best resolution I had was 600 by 400 pixels. And I mean, the picture, if you were standing further than about 4 or 5 feet away, you couldn't tell who it was in that picture. It looked like, I don't know if anybody listening has seen the movie White Noise, where the kind of spirits start coming through the static on the TV. So it's kind of basically like the outline of a person, but that's yeah. where you can tell. Or even like, in the original Poltergeist movie, when she's looking at the static on the
right.
TV and those faces kind of appear. Yeah, that's how my digital camera was. And so for about, I want to say maybe 8 years, yeah, but this, because this was before 2000, for 8 years I didn't actually have a camera of any type whatsoever, until I got the BlackBerry Pearl, and that resolution I think was barely much of a knock up from my previous digital camera. The only advantage being was the screen on the Pearl was only about two sizes of a postage stamp, so it didn't really cause much of an issue.
Right. And of course, even in the infancy, even the flip phones, they used to have cameras on them.
Right.
And you could take a picture on there, but the screen was so small that you would look at it and you'd say, oh, that's a pretty good picture.
Yeah.
But then if you actually had to look at the picture on a normal size, kind of a postcard, you know, piece of paper to look at the picture, it was all pixelated and it was nasty.
Yeah.
Now we have all the filters and everything that make these pictures look so great. And you can take, you know, 200 pictures of yourself versus the old school rolls of 24 exposures in film. Then you had to wait an hour and go to the 1 hour film. And of course that was even an advance in technology to be able to get your pictures back in an hour. You used to had to wait like 2 or 3 days and really want to be serious about that picture you took. Nowadays, I mean, we can snap pictures like crazy. My daughter, who is 17 years old, if you look on her phone, there's a folder in her phone that is called Selfies, and there's 3,000 pictures in her Selfies
wow.
folder that are just pictures of her or her and her friends that she's taken pictures of herself. I don't think... I've even taken 3,000 pictures total in my entire life. Right. And she's had a phone for 3 or 4 years and already has that amount. And that doesn't include the one she's deleted because she didn't think those were good enough. Yeah. So we're probably talking about 30,000 pictures.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, so you have that. But going back to what you were saying about the video camera, I remember our first VCR that we had growing up. My brother used to work for a company called The Associates, and I honestly don't remember too much about what that company did, but they did something with repossessions and all this stuff, and we ended up with a console television and a VCR that was Curtis Mathis brand, and Curtis Mathis has been out of business forever. But our first VCR was a Curtis Mathis VCR. And it was not one piece of equipment. It was two. There were two pieces of equipment that sat on top of that console television. And the one that actually had the recorder was separate. And it had hooks on the side of it. So you could put a strap on it and hook a wire into that VCR to plug into a camera, so the camera itself didn't have the tape in it. You had to carry around the actual recorder on your hip as you were recording film. And I remember my dad making movies off of that camera that he would rent, because we didn't actually have the camera, but he could rent the camera that plugged into the half of the VCR that we had, just to be able to make movies.
Well,
and imagine now where we're at. You don't even think about things like that. So the iPhone, serial killer, it killed all of that stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I know I have a bunch of VHS tapes. You probably have a bunch. A lot of people listening probably has a bunch. It would be probably hard to even find a VCR anymore to plug those in and look at it, because most of it's been digitized, unless it's obviously your home movies or something like that, and you'd struggle to even look at that. So there's one of the industries that the iPhone killed.
The next one, and I was very grateful for this one, was it killed MapsGo or the Road Atlas.
Oh, so I had a friend growing up that his dad had memorized basically every street in the DFW Metroplex, and honestly knew it by the MapsGo grid. So you would go buy these MapsGo binders, and you would say, well, my business is in the DFW MapsGo 27F. And so you would flip to page 27 and you would look at grid square F and you would say, oh, okay, here it is. And so my friend and I would say, hey, we want to go here. We would ask his dad and he would say, oh, it's this road over here. If you look at the MapsGo, it's on page 34 and I think it's either grid square G or H and you'll find it. And I also remember my dad buying a MapsGo every year, and that's how you found everything. And you memorized streets, you knew what your major highways were, you didn't rely on GPS, you didn't rely on plugging in data, you never said, hey, where are you at? Oh, I'm at this address, you know, here's this, and you plug it into your Maps program on your iPhone. You had to give directions. You had to say, okay, well, hop on this highway, take this exit, go down two lights, turn left, and do all this. Now you just say, I'm going to drop a pin. Here's where I'm at. You drop that into your maps, and you can go right to where you're at. It's crazy.
Yeah, now I remember back in, I think it was 2002 specifically, I had a lot of soccer games where I had to travel quite a distance to, and I was still using, you know, MapsGo at the time. And how I used to have to do the navigation, because I didn't know the DFW area that well, was that I would write down on a sheet of paper from my house every single turn-in.
Yeah.
And so I would have to look out for every single turn-in, but that was easier than obviously following the map in the book and having to read it, do stuff at the same time. And I remember once, it was an evening soccer game, and the location was about an hour and a half away. And I got there okay. It's still daylight when I got there. I think it's like about 8 o'clock. Game kicked off and dark at the end. You know, the floodlights had come on. And so I was driving home, and I'd always used to do the instructions in reverse rather than me having to look at the first set and reverse them while I was driving. So anyway, I'm driving in the dark, and it starts raining, and it starts raining quite heavily. And so I'm finding it really hard to like read the road signs. And I miss, I think, like one major one about four turns in, and I ended up going 3 hours too far west past where I lived. I mean, that's how I got messed up. So now, I mean, I was delighted. I mean, obviously we had GPSs before.
Sure.
You know, but with the iPhone, I mean, yeah, I mean, that changed everything in terms of, you know, being able to
just
find yourself. I mean, even walking, you know, even going on trails now and everything. I mean, if you've got an iPhone and you can get a, I mean, you know, as long as you've got a data signal on, and if you're smart, say with something like Google Maps, you'll download a specific area anyway, and that refreshes right. every month. So that way, if you lose a phone signal, because you're always still going to have the GPS signal, you can actually find yourself on a map. Whereas if you're using purely data and you haven't downloaded a map, then you're going to be in trouble if you don't have any...
I remember my dad was in the tower business, and latitude and longitude is a big deal in the tower business. And one of the tower companies sent us a Sony GPS receiver to our house for us to try out. It cost $2,500. And it was about the size of maybe like three iPhones if you stacked them up together. Had a big weight you had to screw into the back of it. You had to calibrate it. It had to capture the GPS satellites. Mm-hmm. And I remember walking from the front door of the house to the mailbox to try to test the distance that we walked back and forth. And the accuracy was terrible.
Yeah.
But we would look at it and say, how great of a device is this? There's going to be something right. that happens. And he still has it, by the way, in his closet.
Wow.
And I'm sure some museum or something like that
would probably
sell that. Yeah, would probably love to have it.
Yeah.
But I was saying that there is definitely some people that are going to take this technology and apply it to true navigation later on. Nowadays, you can, like I said before, put a pin in something and say, here's where I'm at. Not only here's the address I'm at, but I'm standing in this part of this person's front yard right now. And the accuracy is so ridiculous. It's amazing the way that technology has just transformed what we do.
Yeah, and certainly through the APIs, you know, the operating system updates and the addition of, you know, more and more apps in the App Store, you know, the using the GPS has come into a good use in terms of if you walk into a store and you've got that app installed and it comes up with all the coupons available and, you know, what discount there is today.
No, I go to Sam's right now, and my phone knows I'm at Sam's and says, oh, hey, you're at Sam's. And I'm thinking, well, that's kind of creepy. But at the same time, I realize, well, yeah, that's why I have this phone.
Right,
so it knows I'm at Sam's and knows I'm going to do some shopping. Yeah. So it's trying to help me out.
Yeah, so that's good. I think one thing in terms of navigation, I don't necessarily think the iPhone has helped kill, just because I think fans of this item are probably so hardcore that they'd still stick with the original, and that's the compass.
Ah, yeah. So, yeah, the iPhone does have a compass, and I think anyone that has a compass is not relying on their iPhone for a compass.
Right.
And anybody that's probably tried to use the compass on an iPhone honestly probably didn't know how to use the compass to begin with.
Right.
So maybe they didn't kill the compass industry.
Right.
But let's be honest, how much money is the compass industry actually making?
Right.
They might have hurt it a little bit, but they didn't kill it.
Right.
They didn't quite kill it, right?
But I was thinking, like, I don't also quite understand the point of the compass function on the iPhone.
Oh, I totally understand it.
Unless, like I said, you have no data signal, but then what use is a compass really most of the time without a map anyway? And you wouldn't normally be carrying a map because you'd have your iPhone, which has got the maps on it.
But it's because they can. It's because they can. They're showing you, they're saying, look what we can do. It's because we can.
Right.
And that's why it's on there.
Right.
I mean, there's so many things it does that you don't really have a practical use,
right.
But they're just kind of saying, hey, we can do this.
Yeah.
Because we can.
Yeah. Now, one heavy, heavy casualty was the handheld gaming systems. Now, the only kind of company which seemed to have weathered the storm, and this is because they have a lot of fans, even some of the younger ones who are very gung-ho about always purchasing Nintendo stuff. And so, you know, the Nintendo handhelds, they still have a pretty successful range, even
the
so.
The Nintendo Switch.
Yeah.
And maybe you could argue the Sony PSP, a little bit of that.
Yeah, that's kind of died, I think. I'm not sure anybody manufactures for that now.
A lot of it has, because mobile gaming and all that, it's never going to be the same as PC gaming or console gaming.
Yeah.
But it definitely has hurt industries. I mean, you never see anything like the old school. You can't even really call them mobile games, but I remember I had a football game a long time ago that was just dashes on a screen.
Oh, yeah.
And you would play this game or like Pocket Simon or things like that. So, those are long, long dead. If you're going to mobile game, you can either use your phone or maybe in Nintendo's doing well. They're trying to say, hey, we're going to have this device. And, of course, what do? They say, well, we can detach the controllers. You can plug this into the TV and have a true console experience.
Right.
So it's a hybrid.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go 50-50 on that one.
Yeah.
I'm going to go 50-50.
Well, I mean, the thing is, the rule used to be with consoles and handhelds that you would lose money actually with the consoles and the handhelds when you sold them. So say with like the newest Xbox, if it's $500 for the base model for the Series X, it probably costs Microsoft $600 for that. Now, I'm not just talking in terms of parts, but in terms of all the money which was spent in R&D and development, that they actually take a loss up to that point of the console. And where companies traditionally make up this money is through the software.
Right.
Which they license.
Well, it's the grocery store model.
Yeah.
So if you go in the grocery store right now and you go buy milk, eggs, and bread, and this is true today, if you go to the grocery store today and all you buy is milk, eggs, and bread, you walk out of there, it costs the grocery store money.
Yeah.
Everything they're selling you costs them more than what they sell it to you for. It's called a loss leader, because they want you to go in and buy milk, eggs, and bread, but they also want to sell you all this other stuff that they make higher margins on, but they know you need milk, eggs, and bread, and maybe butter or whatever. You know, pick your poison, right? Your staples, they're going to lose money on. They want you to buy the candy bar at the checkout line that's a dollar that they paid 15 cents for. That's why they bury milk, eggs, and bread at the back of the store. So they make you pass by everything else. So it totally makes sense why even the console companies say, we got to get you the console so you can buy the other products, and that's where we're going to make our money.
Yeah, now I can understand with consoles, because, you know, that's a sitting down, more of a relaxing experience. And certainly now with digital downloads, since they came out, it's made life a lot easier that you don't have to go to somewhere like GameStop or wherever and buy the game. You can get the download and then it's easy to transfer across, you know, if you upgrade your Xbox.
Or you don't have to worry about, you know, where did I put the disc? Did I scratch the disc? Did, you know, the cat get out and poop on the disc? Did one of the kids get mad that somebody else was playing the disc, so they hid it in a plant in the house and now nobody can find it? Absolutely.
So that goes to what I don't understand about the handheld model, is that, you know, I don't think there's any handheld gaming devices at the moment that have a screen bigger than an iPhone screen, a regular iPhone screen, let alone a Plus. And so what I'm saying in terms of that, you know, and the graphics obviously aren't going to be any better than a 60 frame per second Retina screen, but you have to remember these games, these handheld games, take cartridges or discs.
True.
And they cost upwards of $20 or $30, whereas you can go onto the iTunes store, find a copycat type game, and every popular game there's at least a dozen or so copycats of it, and probably get one of these games for free or for 99 cents, rather than paying $20 or $30 for a cartridge. And so, and also you have,
by the way, you're going to lose that cartridge because they're small.
Yeah, and there's an infinite, well, not infinite, but you know what I mean, in terms of games playable, you know, off the iTunes store, off the App Store. Whereas cartridges, I mean, really at $20 or $30 a game, I mean, how many of those cartridges are you going to end up actually buying? I mean, you better really kind of love that game.
And let's be honest, I think you're trying to be a little bit nice here. I think it's more like $40 or $50 for some of those games.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was thinking about secondhand prices if you went to somewhere like GameStop.
Oh, fair enough.
You know, because there's no point buying cartridges brand new when you can buy a secondhand version of it, you know, unless you're desperate for the new release.
Yeah. So there's another casualty of the iPhone machine. What else have they destroyed?
Ironically enough, MP3 players, right up including the iPod itself, which was the best MP3 player of all, but the iPhone actually managed to destroy the iPod.
That is true. It's kind of a self-casualty. I mean, I had an iPod before I had my iPhone. In fact, I had an iPod, and then I ended up having, you know, a BlackBerry and everything else before I ended up with an iPhone. And the iPhone itself, I remember when the, what was it called? The iPod Touch came out, which basically looked just like an iPhone. But they said, oh, but it's not an iPhone. It's an iPod Touch, so it will do everything an iPhone will do, but you can't put a SIM card in it and it can't make phone calls. And they tried to get that to take hold for, I don't know what it was, like a year or two.
But it actually could take phone calls if you downloaded apps like Text Free and did voice over IP over Wi-Fi.
But you had to be on Wi-Fi. Yeah, you couldn't be anywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, so it did a pretty good job. And in fact, my kids had the iPod Touch. In fact, my parents bought it for them from Apple and actually had engravings on the back saying, you know, from grandma and grandpa, and put their names on them. And that lasted, you know, a few years. And then they had the iPhones, because it's ironic how iPhone created this technology and then killed some of the other technology they were famous for creating. Because I've had several MP3 players. I had mini-disc MP3 players from Sony. And then, you know, years ago, I was a big Sony fan. If it was Sony, that's what I bought. I was a big mini-disc fan, all that good stuff. And then all of a sudden, all that stuff started dying out because Apple was taking it over. And they were saying that, look, our stuff's so much simpler. Just buy into us. You know, it's easier to use. And so I did. And all that stuff kind of disappeared, and it killed off all of these other technologies like we're talking about. So, yeah, ironically, Apple had the better MP3 player, and they killed it themselves to get everybody else to go to the iPhone.
Now, didn't you mention that I think it was the iPod is where the term podcast actually came from, or was
actually it is, because when the first iPods came out, they determined that it was a good idea to go ahead and let people broadcast stuff over the internet through RSS feeds and let people download this stuff whenever they plug their iPod in and bring stuff into their iPod so they could listen to it. And, of course, the old-school iPods were not connected to the internet all the time. They didn't have Wi-Fi. You had to plug them in. You had to dump MP3 files to it or whatever. But you could subscribe to podcasts. And once you plugged in your iPod, you had your subscription to podcasts, and it would dump all of the new episodes of the podcast onto your iPod. And as much as a lot of podcasters hate Apple, podcasting comes from the iPod. And that's what we're sitting here doing. And it's kind of ironic that you and I both, we have Apple products, and so we're Apple fans, but there's all these other networks out there that have podcasts that say we're against the Apple machine, but they're still using their name for podcasts. Yeah. That's where that comes from.
Yeah. Now, the next one I wanted to touch on very briefly was alarm clocks. Now, I've always hated traditional alarm clocks. I've bought some novelty ones before, which have played, you know, a tune or something. But it's one of those where, you know, you really get bored of that same tune. And I think your brain gets used to it and ends up kind of blocking it out. And after a while, it stops being effective. And it all the other effective type of alarm noises, you know, I always just get pretty angry when I was woken up by an alarm clock. And my first reaction when I heard either like that screeching kind of beeping or whatever it was, were like the alarm clock was just saying, get up, you loser, go to work. You know why you have to go to work? Because you're a loser. You suck. Go to work.
Yeah, because you don't have a YouTube channel where you're unwrapping toys and you get 30 million views a day and you're 8 years old. So go to work, loser. Yeah, no, I totally get that. But at the same time, we got rid of our alarm clock years ago, and we use our phones for alarms. And for a while, I had always loved the first track off of the Smashing Pumpkins, Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness. Yeah. The actual track called Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness.
Off tonight,
and, and it was, just before that song. Yeah. And that's what I would wake up to. Then I read an article. And that article said, do not wake up to a song that you actually like because you'll start to hate it. And I truly started to hate that song after I used that song as a alarm tone for a while. It's like my boy right now, Jake, he loves waking up to System of Down, Chop Suey.
Right.
You know, it's wake up, grab a brush, put a little makeup. He thinks it's funny.
Yeah.
Now all of a sudden he's saying, well, I hate that song.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, yeah, you attribute that to the fact that you're waking up.
Right.
And now you start to hate that song. Yeah. So it's almost better to play a song that you absolutely hate. So then when you hear that song go off on your alarm and you say, oh, I hate that, and you want to shut it off immediately. Because even with Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness, I could hit the snooze button and I would listen to it three or four more times. And then I got to maybe three more times, then maybe two more times. Then finally I had to go back to a default alert tone because I hated hearing that. And I actually had to take it off of my Spotify playlist because I loved that song, but now I can't stand to hear it. And I convinced myself that I don't want to hear that song anymore. So if you have something in your alarms right now that you like, I suggest you pick something you absolutely hate.
Yeah.
And that's what you want to wake you up in the morning.
Yeah. Well, do you think that theory works in reverse? So if you play a song which at the moment you hate, but you play it before you're going to eat a nice meal or before you get to go to bed and stuff, do you think eventually you'll associate that song with nice things so you'll actually start liking the song?
You know, I think that might work for some people. It wouldn't work for me.
Right, yeah.
There are certain songs or certain TV shows or whatever. You can put them in front of me as much as you want. I'm still not going to like them.
Right.
I would rather put something in front of me that just makes me want to shut it off so I don't hear it again.
Yeah.
Versus something that maybe I'm going to be tricked psychologically into actually liking.
Yeah. So yeah, I've, you know, not used an alarm clock since, you know, I had the option on a phone, and I think even the phone I had before the BlackBerry Pearl, I think I had a Nokia one, and then there was an alarm on that, And so I used to use that. And the good thing about it is obviously the phone can be a little bit more in easy reach unless you particularly want to sleep with the alarm clock, you know. But one of the things I wanted to move on to, and a very, very obvious one, is calculators.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was always that speech that every math teacher always gave in high school or even middle school that said, well, you have to learn this because you're not always going to have a calculator with you. Now we all do. Every one of us do. And even if you are to the point to where you don't understand the way your smartphone works, but you had somebody to teach you about Siri or Hey Google or something like that, you can still ask them and they're going to solve the math for you. In fact, not to just boost up iPhone, but then they had that new deal with Measure that came out where you can take the pictures and do the measurements,
it comes up with
the area and the circumference and all of that. So we basically said, well, yes, we have all this math knowledge out there, but it's all available to everybody right now. You've got a calculator, you've got access to the internet. Why do we even care? And we have entered that point in society where we literally all have a calculator in our pocket right now.
Yeah, now I remember actually a few teachers giving that you won't always have a calculator on your speech. And I was an absolute nerd at the time, and I bought one of those Casio calculator watches.
Oh, I remember those.
So every time the teacher used to say that, I just used to hold my wrist in the air and tap the front of my watch so everybody behind me could see.
I had a friend in high school I don't know if it was a Casio, but he had a watch that was analog on the face. But then you grabbed a hold of the face and flipped it up, and underneath had a digital calculator that he could type in.
I saw one of those.
He was a little bit hoity-toity. I mean, you know, he had a little bit more money, but he still had the ability to have a calculator on him the whole time.
But, you know, the funny thing is, despite the fact I think I had that watch for maybe about 3 years, but then I decided I might want a girlfriend, so I got rid of it. I think I only ever used that calculator maybe 6 times across 3 years. I mean,
well, I remember the movie Singles. I don't know if this was big in the UK or not, but in the movie Singles, they were going out to a club and the guy was talking about how he had this watch and it could hold 20 phone numbers. And it was a calculator watch.
Yeah.
So it had a memory function that could store phone numbers. And he said, I'm going to fill this up with phone numbers. And at the end of, you know, their night out or whatever, he said, I've got 20 phone numbers in this watch. And we're talking about early 90s, right?
Yeah.
This is when, in fact, in that movie.
Now, did he have to use one of those little pens? No,
he was just tapping on the
watch. Because I had a friend who had one. The buttons on it were so small. It had on the side of it, it had this little kind of pull-out pen, which you then extended, and you had to use that to hit the buttons.
Yeah, but you also got to remember the people that were wearing those watches probably had little fingers, so it wasn't that big of a deal.
Right, you mean like midgets?
Or witches or gingers.
Well, I think we can probably do some study on how many midgets find the iPhone Plus models too difficult to use because of their short...
But we digress.
But anyway,
But going on to there, I'm sure, in not to jump ahead on you, but kind of storing phone numbers. I mean, the Rolodex, that's got to be on your list, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I remember Rolodex, years ago memorizing my friends' phone numbers. I mean, I had everybody's phone number memorized. And I'm not trying to tout myself, but a lot of people either had it memorized or they had some kind of card. I had a friend in high school that had a card he kept in his wallet that had people's phone numbers written on it. Now, I mean, you give me your phone number, I don't even bother trying to memorize it. I just put it in my phone.
Yeah.
So if I get locked up in jail, if they take my phone away from me and you're my one phone call, I probably won't know it because I've stored it in my phone because I don't have to memorize it anymore. And so it's taken away from actually trying to learn things because we're so enamored and attached to our phones. And we say, okay, here's how I get a hold of you. That's all we worry about.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. Another one where I think it really has pretty much eliminated the industry is dictionaries and encyclopedias.
Oh, so I don't know if this was a big thing in the UK, but I remember growing up, we would go to the grocery store and, you know, you'd buy the groceries and they always had version, or not version, but, and not chapter, but basically like number one of the encyclopedia.
Right.
And if you came back every week, you could get the next one.
Right.
And you could eventually get the whole collection of encyclopedias.
Yeah.
And if you had a full collection of encyclopedias at your house, that was amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, just to have a full collection of 1 through 26 of the encyclopedias, that was amazing. Then then it went to CD-ROMs. You would buy a computer, and then you'd get the encyclopedia on maybe two CD-ROMs, and you'd say, well, all those books that we used to have to wait and spend like $4 a week to try to collect the whole set of books, now we have them on two CD-ROMs. Yeah, I mean, and I know this is before my time. I don't know about you and what happened in the UK, but I do remember hearing stories about the door-to-door encyclopedia salesman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I never saw one. Did you ever see one?
I didn't see one, but I mean, they definitely existed. I think, I don't know what the product was over here, but the main product when it came out on CD, I think was called a Encyclopedia Britannica.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was big over here.
Yeah. And,
There were two. There was Britannica and there was World Book
right.
Encyclopedia. So yeah. I don't know if y'all had that over there or not.
Yeah. And I mean, along with, you know, libraries, you know, it certainly, unless you're after perhaps some microfiche of some old newspaper, you know, the majority of the books in the library now are pretty redundant, just simply in terms of, you know, how quickly you can switch to different article from different books on a browser on your phone, as opposed to skipping actually physically through a book, through multiple books, and then trying to find what it is you want. You know, I mean, it's so much quicker as well on a phone. It's not just more convenient.
Well, and of course on the phone, because it's internet based, you can click on certain things on those articles and it's going to take you to something else on the internet, where the encyclopedia might say, oh, see this article. And this is, you're reading book 20 and you got to go to book 12 to cross-reference it.
Right.
Now it's all, like you say, from a phone, or even back then in a CD. Yeah, it killed the door-to-door encyclopedia salesman, and now it's killed the encyclopedia deal. And then, of course, you got Wikipedia now, which is basically saying, well, we want to be the online encyclopedia, but we let everybody else come in here and edit everything, and now it's mistrusted. But once again, another rabbit hole.
Yeah,
maybe we go down one other time, but so there's another one that the smartphone, the iPhone, killed.
Yeah, and along with that, closely related, books, magazines, newspapers.
Right.
I mean, I know a lot of people still like, you know, books for traditional reasons.
Yeah, physically hold them. To smell those pages.
And some people are like that with newspapers, but I think that's a dying breed.
It is.
And with magazines, I think the predominant market by a long, long way now is, you know, female magazines, you know, housekeeping magazines, because males, you know, they'd used to buy maybe some of the Keep Fit magazines or some of the, you know, auto car maintenance, but it's so much easier now to look at something, you know, which you want to know through YouTube or online. And, you know, that goes for exercise, cars, or anything. Most of the kind of traditional male preferential activities, whereas women, I think, still kind of like that magazine, that kind of open, you know, physical cookbook and stuff. But for the most part, it's forced, you know, a lot of newspapers and magazines online, so they can still be accessed with a subscription, so they can still make money. So they've had to adjust to the iPhone technology rather than, you know,
the other way around.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the smartphone, and not to get too deep into something like a tablet, like an iPad or a Kindle or the Barnes & Noble Nook or whatever that's kind of started to kill books. I mean, you're always going to have your purists that want to read a book. They want to sit there. They want to smell that smell of a book, especially old books. You know, they want to go to an old bookstore and grab an old book and do that. But that's a very small piece of the population.
Right.
Somebody hears about a book that's came out. They want to say, oh, I like that book. They want to click a button on their phone. In 10 seconds, they have that book. Then they can start reading it. And now we've gotten even so much more lazy to where now you can have the Audible version and somebody's going to read it to you.
Right.
Because somebody didn't have the time to read it. They want somebody to read it to them.
Yeah.
But more power to them. I mean, that's why we have to use technology to go ahead and push forward. And
yeah.
I don't have any problem with somebody reading me a book.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that.
Sure. Yeah. One which I think is quite controversial, because although I think smartphones contributed to the demise, I think it was more the birth of internet radio which led to this. And this is basically traditional radio as in a physical item basically dying out when you have the choice of having your smartphone and obviously buying a decent pair of speakers, Bluetooth speakers. You can do exactly the same thing as you could with the radio, except you can play stuff, you know, you like all the time, and skip channels a lot easier. And
yeah, you know, it kind of killed that. It killed that medium of buying that entertainment media. I mean, it really hurt that industry, but it also opened up the avenue for people that wanted to present stuff out there that they didn't have the ability before, because they had to have that intermediary. They had to have a gatekeeper that said, this is what we want you to listen to. And kind of goes with podcasts. You know, podcasts now, people can choose what they want to hear, what they want to listen to. And I think it's a great thing that we've kind of opened that up to say, hey, you want to listen to this? Great. We're not going to force you to listen to this, but we hope you'll listen to this. And everybody's happy.
Right.
Everybody has that freedom of choice that before it was the illusion of choice, because somebody somewhere as a gatekeeper was saying, here's the things you get to choose from. Now there's truly all kinds of choice out there.
Yeah, and I know we pretty much could go on for hours with this list of everything, so I'm just going to skip over these next ones. Voice recorders, landlines, payphones, flashlights, calendars, watches, wall clocks, photo albums, even something as simple as a trip to the bank, pages, beepers, board and card games, post-its, reminder notes, pedometers. So, I mean, there's obviously a whole bunch of stuff, and that's by no means an ultimate list. That was just a small section I got through the research. So, you know, the iPhone has helped to disrupt or destroy a lot of traditional industries. But I think the industry which it has actually affected more than anything else and forcing it to undergo evolution is probably the music industry.
Oh, I totally agree that the music industry has probably been hit the hardest with the advent of the iPhone, and even maybe you could argue before the advent of the iPhone with the MP3 file and music sharing and burning CDs, because they were the original gatekeepers. They were saying, these bands over here are the ones we want you to hear because we can make money off these guys. Versus what we have now, where you can be an artist and the record company or the record label or whatever you want to call them, you can be an artist, not have one of those, make a living off that, and there aren't A&R people that are going to make money, and there's not some big tower in Los Angeles or New York or whatever that are putting all this out. And they're trying to figure out what to do. And I feel bad for them. I mean, I really do, because there is no gatekeeper, there's a lot of crap that gets out there.
Sure.
Let's be honest.
Yeah.
I mean, so now what we've done is we've said, well, let's let the general public sift through everything and find what's good.
Right.
Versus the gatekeeper that used to sit out there and sift through what was good and tell you what to listen to.
Sure.
And that's been one of the biggest hits. And it's the same with books, with vanity publishing.
Yeah.
Used to, if you were going to put a book out, you had to have a publisher. Now you've got to sift through all that to try to find out what the good book is. Yeah. And all that. And so we punted that back to the consumer.
Yeah.
And we've told the consumer, it's your responsibility to figure out what's good.
Yeah.
What you want to listen to, what you want to read. But it's a double-edged sword, because at the same time, it's very easy to put stuff out that you say is true that's not true. And so that same consumer can say, well, this is news and this is true. This is science and it's really not. And it's very hard to determine what's true and what's false.
Sure.
Yeah, there's sites like The Onion and Babylon Bee, which do fantastic writing. I mean, just absolutely fantastic writing. But if you don't know that it's satirical in nature, you might say, well, this is a news source.
Yeah.
And they say this is true, and somebody shares it, and all of a sudden a snowball effect happens because it looks like a legitimate news source.
Yeah.
Or, if you look at somebody like Weird Al Yankovic, and all he does is parody songs, but they're popular, and you're like, well, this is popular music, and these things he's saying is what Americans like to listen to, we could confuse everyone. So the loss of the gatekeepers, maybe that is the true serial killer victim of the iPhone, is the gatekeeper.
Yeah. And actually, this just reminds me of a joke. We were talking earlier about the snobbery behind owning an iPhone, and it kind of dropped off, but now it's come back a little bit with the high price of the newer models. And I remember reading this comment from a guy who was in the dating pool, and he was on Match.com and a few of these other ones, HeHarmony or whatever.
Did his name start with an E and it ends with a Rick?
No. Oh, no, this wasn't okay. Him. No. But
Love you, Eric, and if you're listening, yeah. We're trying not to make fun
of you. We try not to make that obvious, but E followed by Rick, kind of, you know. But anyway, so he was on various stadium websites, and every now and then he'd get, chatting on the online chat with these girls and be like, oh yeah, I'd like to take this further or meet up. And, I'm guessing in dating websites, that's like two or three texts, not like 24. Okay. So he'd get the numbers and he'd text them. And when he got a text back, if it was a green text, he said the first thought which came into his head was, I bet she's probably got six kids from four different dads.
Yep. Can't afford an iPhone because it's not blue. And everybody looks at that now. I cringe. And like we said at the beginning of this, we both have iPhones. So if I get a text from somebody and it's green, I'm like, you cheap so-and-so.
Yeah.
So you don't have an iPhone, you can't iMessage me. You can't AirDrop something to me.
Yeah.
And it's terrible that we've created that kind of, what did you call it earlier? Kind of just that. I honestly don't even know what to call it, but this kind of subculture of iPhone users that if you don't see that blue on the text message. You almost look at it like a fake news source. It's like, oh, this came in green. This isn't as good of a text message as it would be if it came in as blue. And I almost hate to see this. I hate to get into a group text where everything's not blue. If there's somebody that doesn't have an iPhone and then it turns into a true text message or SMS thing and now it's all green. I'm like, I don't really want to respond to this as much. It kind of sucks. I mean, it really does kind of suck, but that's the mindset that Apple has put us in now.
Well,
they really have.
Yeah. Well, I really hope that at some future iOS update, they do actually, if it has to come through green, they can at least tell us it came through on a Samsung or something because that's a little bit different. You know, that's kind of equivalent model in technology and almost equivalent price-wise. And I mean, they're pretty much neck and neck in terms of innovation.
Yeah, but you know what? You know they'll never do that.
Well,
they will never do that. I see where you're going, and that would make a lot of sense. It's like at least you're sending this from a reasonable phone.
But a Google Pixel? Because can you imagine trying to find somebody else who owned a Google Pixel? It'll be easier to be a furry in 1980 and find another furry without help of the internet.
Yeah, absolutely. And with all that said, thanks for tuning into this episode of The Wolf and the Shepherd. We're glad you joined us. Please share this with your friends. We appreciate all your support, and we look forward to talking to you next time.